This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. This is the podcast that's designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region, so thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of February 2nd, 2026. It's Super Bowl week, and while the game won't be in Arizona this year, a good share of the betting will be. Last year, Arizonans spent more than $8 billion on sports gambling, and as the business continues to grow, state leaders want a bigger piece of the action to fill major budget gaps. Phil Latzman spoke with an ASU expert for more on how it could work and why sports gambling has to change in the wake of recent scandals.
Well, right now, the state gets only about 10% of taxable revenues from those popular sports betting sites we see ads for, like FanDuel and Caesars and DraftKings. They make up the majority of Arizona's gambling action. In Governor Katie Hobbs's proposed budget, she's calling for that rate to be raised to 45% in order to add another $150 million to state coffers. But is that realistic? Daniel McIntosh is a marketing professor in the sports business program as part of ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business.
Governor Hobbs is suggesting that we increase it from 10% to 45%, but specifically is carving that out only for casinos that are operating at over $75 million a month. And so currently in the state, only four really meet that. We're talking DraftKings, Caesars, Fanatics, and FanDuel. So it would really only be on those bigger players. They account for anywhere between 70 and 80% of the market.
Arizona's current sportsbook tax rate is fifth lowest in the nation for states that approved online sports gambling. New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Illinois go as high as 50%. The tax rate increase would not apply to Arizona's brick and mortar casinos, only on the online sportsbooks that McIntosh says take in the majority of the handle.
At 10%, we are, again, on the very, very low end of where we could be. Now, the margins for these casinos are pretty small. It's usually in the world of, 2 to 3% in terms of what they're making as profit. So it is a substantial, net decrease for their cash flow operations. But again, remember that a lot of these are operating digitally, so they don't have a physical footprint in the state. A lot of those dollars then make their way to whether it's Las Vegas, New York, where the corporate headquarters are.
Sports betting has exploded since the 2018 Supreme Court decision legalizing regulated operations outside of Nevada. According to the website Legal Sports Report, more than $600 billion has been wagered nationwide since. McIntosh, who takes part in the school's economic studies for major events like the Super Bowl, says it's feasible to expect more revenue from this growing industry.
Last year, we had close to $8.5 billion wagered in the state. So it is a very substantial amount of money that is exchanging hands. I don't have a problem with the government increasing the tax rate on the operators to better the lives of the citizens and the communities that are, kind of spending those dollars.
But there may be a bigger problem to solve first, saving the integrity of the games to bet on. A series of recent scandals in the NBA, Major League Baseball, and even in college athletics has exposed vulnerabilities in the system, mostly when it comes to what are called prop bets, enabling gamblers to wager on individual athletes.
What I have found to be, kind of most problematic, we talk about developing lifelong fans. And when you allow your fans to bet on individual players or to bet on individual statistical outputs, let's say I'm a huge Devin Booker fan and I think he's going to score 20 points and he only scores 19. The Suns win by 25 points, but Devin Booker only got 19 points. We can have, a subset of fans that are unhappy with the outcome of the game.
And McIntosh says ultimately unhappy with their favorite players.
It drives increased engagement, but does it drive increased avidity? What are the impacts to the long-term development of our fans, our fan bases, and what are some of the negative externalities? Our players are very active on social media, as they should be, but some of them will, admit after a bad game, they cannot go on social media because of the negative blowback, the negative comments.
Do you think that there needs to be some change, especially with the prop betting, in order for the integrity of sports to remain intact?
I think so, absolutely, and you're already seeing that in baseball, right? When you've got a pitcher that's spiking pitches on the first one, and whether it has any impact on the outcome of the event itself, it's having an impact on the integrity or the perceived integrity of the game.
That's ASU sports business professor Daniel McIntosh. And as for increasing the tax rate on sportsbook revenue in Arizona, that could face major obstacles. Republicans at the Capitol are traditionally opposed to any form of tax increases, and the state constitution requires a two-thirds supermajority from legislators for laws that increase state revenues. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
In business news, Phoenix has a reputation of a boom town where old buildings, historical or not, often get demolished. Now a music studio where artists such as Waylon Jennings and Alice Cooper once recorded is under new use as a marijuana dispensary, Matthew Casey reports.
Hip-hop thumps the asphalt of a dispensary parking lot in Midtown Phoenix, almost shaking promotional tents set up by many of Arizona's marijuana brands.
I mean, listen, cannabis has never been far from music. Those two things go hand in hand.
Aaron Dubois is VP of marketing for Story Cannabis, which is in the midst of a grand reopening of a space once known as Audio Recorders.
You could throw a rock and hit a dozen dispensaries around here. None of them have the heritage that this building has.
Hit songs were recorded in this area decades before hip-hop swept the globe. In the 1960s, that success led to construction of what was once the top studio between Dallas and L.A. Weed may have been around then, too, says John Dixon, Arizona's unofficial music historian.
I don't know. There might have been a little there. I think it was more probably in those days, Benny's, speed pills and stuff, and alcohol.
Post-war 1940s saw the launch of Ramsey's recording studio in Phoenix. It didn't take long before Square Dance records and commercials were being made there. Another early moneymaker was setting people's poems to music.
A lot of people would just kind of come in the front door, hey, I want to make a record. They'd take them in, they'd do it, they'd cut a couple acetates. And
in the 50s, the studio recorded two hits. First was Sanford Clark's The Fool.
Your glass is high and drink to a fool, a crazy.
The second hit, recorded the same year the studio name became Audio Recorders, was Duane Eddy's Rebel Rouser, which Dixon calls the twang heard round the world.
It was huge here, it was huge in England, it was huge in Australia. They had this international hit here in 1958. That all these local guys had created in that little studio.
Which was just down the street from the building that is now the marijuana dispensary. Dixon calls those years the golden age of audio recorders.
They were successful across the street in the new big building, but this was what got them there.
The move came in 1964 to a studio big enough to record the Phoenix Symphony. Having been stocked with the best equipment available, drew big names like Waylon Jennings.
Someone's gonna get hurt before you're through.
Also, the Spiders, which became Alice Cooper. The business evolved over decades into selling cameras and video equipment. The studio was sold in the early 90s. Dixon says it had several incarnations since, including video game development.
Phoenix is so big about knocking. Okay, goodbye. It's old. We don't need it. Boom. It's gone.
Back inside the weed shop, the grand opening is in full swing. Dubois, the marketer for Story Cannabis, says history disappears if nobody pays attention, and he's searching for a way to pay tribute to the past. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In politics news, the chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors subpoenaed staffers from County Recorder Justin Heap's office after they made contradictory claims in court and public meetings that some voters were disenfranchised in past elections. From the politics desk, Wayne Shutsky reports.
Chairwoman Kate Brophy-McGee signed subpoenas calling on Heap's chief of staff Sam Stone and two other employees to testify before the board next week. That came after Stone and another staffer said in court that changes to state law and a lack of resources led to voter disenfranchisement in recent election cycles.
Based on the number of provisionals that are not processed by the end of each election, we estimate that it is between one and several hundred in each election.
Stone made the comments after being asked about the recorder's request that the county purchase a sorting machine to help it process provisional ballots more quickly. Those are ballots given to voters who can't be immediately verified at the polls for a variety of reasons, including not providing valid identification. At a meeting with the board a few days later, Heap appeared to walk back the claims that voters were disenfranchised in the last election.
We stated that we want this machine to make sure that we don't disenfranchise voters. We didn't say that any voters had been disenfranchised since I took office in the administration.
In a statement, Brophy-McGee says she subpoenaed the staffers so they can, quote, answer questions directly and clarify critical facts. Wayne Chutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting the Dash with Rio 5K and 10K Run Walk in Tempe on Saturday, April 18th. This community event welcomes runners and walkers of all levels with early bird registration for a limited time. Details at dashwithrio.com.
In water news, Governor Katie Hobbs says she's cautiously optimistic that Western states are moving towards a deal on the Colorado River. Alex Hager reports that's on the heels of a meeting in D.C. where Hobbs met with other governors and federal water leaders.
The seven states can't agree on how to share the pain of cutbacks to a shrinking water supply. Hobbs says they probably won't meet a mid-February deadline for a new agreement, but they'll be on the right path by then.
We were clearly at an impasse. I feel like we're at a place where we can start to move past that now.
State leaders appear to be moving toward a short-term deal for the river. The feds cautioned against a five-year deal that would kick the can down the road, but Hobbs says a short deal could serve as a bridge to a longer-term agreement. Alex Hager, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Indigenous Affairs, a bipartisan bill on Capitol Hill is looking to turn one of Arizona's federal monuments into the state's fourth national park, behind Saguaro, the Petrified Forest, and the Grand Canyon. Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
Established in 1924 by President Calvin Coolidge, Chiricahua National Monument is known by many as the Wonderland of Rocks. From Geronimo to Cochise, this land is also steeped in Apache history, something the San Carlos Apache tribe and neighboring Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico want to see permanently protected. The effort is being led by Democratic U.S. Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, as well as Republican Representative Juan Ciscomani in the House. Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News, Mexico and the U.S. agreed to a 60-day action plan aimed at developing trade policies for critical minerals. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Nina Kravinsky has more.
The action plan compels Mexico and the U.S. to discuss a set of coordinated trade policies, including possible price floors for certain critical minerals. Critical minerals are raw materials designated by governments as vital for their economy or national security. The document doesn't mention China by name, but the U.S. has long looked for ways to circumvent that country's lock on refining many critical minerals. Vice President J.D. Vance said ahead of a critical minerals event with delegations from dozens of countries that the U.S. hopes to form a, quote, trading bloc with allies. The agreement with Mexico comes a few months before the U.S., Mexico, and Canada are set to review their trade treaty. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show, a conversation on the reaction in the city of Surprise over the expected new ICE facility. Here's co-host Sam Dingman.
All right. I have now pulled up outside the facility. It is absolutely massive. And I'm just driving around. It is really desolate back here. It's a Tuesday night, and I'm driving around the empty parking lot of a warehouse in Surprise, Arizona. Pale gray and white walls stretch for hundreds of yards in every direction. The building seems to extend forever into the darkness. In the front, there's a locked gate that leads to a vast expanse of asphalt, lit by harsh fluorescent lamps, surrounded by rows and rows of industrial-size garage doors. The size of this place is remarkable, but other than that, it is the most boring-looking series of blank, rectangular structures you can possibly imagine. It is utterly devoid of character. Now, most of the time, when it comes to warehouses, this aggressively nondescript design concept is intentional. Warehouses aren't supposed to have character. They're not supposed to make you feel anything. But this warehouse is different. People are furious about this warehouse because about a week ago, the Department of Homeland Security bought it.
ICE has purchased a massive warehouse in the West Valley. The filings say the 400,000 square foot facility near Sweetwater Avenue and Dysart Road in Surprise was bought for $70 million last Friday. There haven't been any plans announced for this facility, but there have been reports that ICE has been buying similar facilities for detention centers. We have reached out to the city of Surprise as well as DHS for it.
A few miles down the road from the warehouse, outside the City Hall building in Surprise, a crowd of hundreds is swarming the entrance. There is a city council meeting tonight, which, until recently, had a relatively normal agenda. The VFW was scheduled to give an award to a firefighter, someone from the Public Works Department was presenting a proposal about streetlights, and, as with most meetings, there was also a section reserved for a public hearing. A time for citizens to address the council with their concerns. Tonight, over 100 people have signed up to speak. They want to talk about the warehouse. Many of them, like Blanche, felt blindsided by the news that DHS had bought it.
We were never given any notice that this was going to happen. It just went down like that. Not right.
After the news about the warehouse broke, the city of Surprise released a statement saying it was, quote, not aware that there were efforts underway to purchase the building, was not notified of the transaction by any of the parties involved, and has not been contacted by DHS or any federal agency about the intended use of the building. Many of the people gathered at City Hall tonight are not satisfied with that explanation. There is a line stretching down the block to get into the meeting, which is already so full they've opened an overflow room next to the main council chamber. One of the people waiting to get in is Nancy, who tells me the warehouse is particularly offensive to her, considering the origins of Surprise. In the city's early days, she says, many of its residents were migrant farmers.
The idea that we're going to put a building up to throw people in and probably be treated inhumanely is just absolutely a disgrace to the history of this city.
A little before six, a city official announces that both meeting rooms are full, and they can't let anyone else in. The crowd has swelled past 1,000 people now, and they are getting louder.
I so hope! I so hope! I so hope! I so hope!
Inside, Surprise Mayor Kevin Sarter calls the meeting to order.
Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
Mayor Sarter.
Present.
Vice Mayor Greenberg.
Here.
Councilman Haney.
Here.
The council moves through some preliminary agenda items, and then, about an hour in, Sarter addresses the packed chamber.
So before I open the call to the public, I just want to thank everyone for being here. I know many of you signed up to speak, and I want you to know that this council is here to listen to you.
The mayor reiterates that the city didn't know the warehouse was being purchased by DHS. He says they can't regulate the purchase or the way the warehouse is used, but that the council is genuinely committed to hearing people's thoughts and concerns.
And so we're going to hear from people on both sides of this. And I ask you that you respect one another. I don't want to hear cheering or clapping. I know we're passionate about it, but I don't want one person to feel intimidated, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on. We're going to listen to you.
A long line forms in the aisle, leading up to a podium that faces the mayor and the council members. One of the first speakers is actually a supporter of ICE. He says the agents are just doing their jobs.
We are all neighbors here. In Surprise, and I hope we would work with ICE and with our local police so they can do their job. To my knowledge, we do not know yet if this facility is to store their equipment or to temporarily house illegals before deportation. But either way, why are some people against it? I can't answer that question.
One second, sir. I asked at the beginning of this that we're going to respect each other. I know that we have passion about it, but we need to really respect, give this man his time. Like, we're going to get you your time.
The crowd quiets down and lets the man finish. He will prove to be one of only two ICE supporters to address the council. For the next 4 hours, dozens and dozens of people take to the podium to denounce the warehouse and everything it represents.
My husband is from Guatemala, and he works for the U.S. United States Postal Service, and he's in our neighborhoods all the time. I make him carry his U.S. passport card with him because I'm scared to death they're going to grab him off the street.
We're not talking about normal law enforcement. Normal law enforcement follows the rules of the United States, the Constitution, and is accountable. We're talking about the creation of a police force similar to what Nazi Germany had in the 1930s, with his total disregard to the citizens of the country that they're supposedly protecting.
This is not a Democrat or Republican issue. It is an issue about human dignity. I stand for the dignity of life in all of its forms, the unborn, victims of crime, those on death row, and immigrants.
We as students are going to be heavily affected as this detention center is right down our road. I get a pit in my stomach when I think about how in a few months I have to go to school knowing humans are screaming for help and not getting the rights they deserve.
While you may not have all been involved in the purchase, not doing anything about this will make you complicit in facilitating this unimaginable cruelty that's going to go on there.
I formally request that the City of Surprise pass a resolution demanding DHS and ICE publicly disclose operational plans, community impact assessments, and clear points of contact for ongoing communication.
I don't want it anywhere near this state. I want that to be clear. I hate this.
I would hate for Surprise to be a place where the stain of what's going on in Minneapolis would play out here as well. Because that would mean that you guys have technically failed us as citizens. Thank you for your time.
A little after 11 o'clock, the mayor finally adjourns the meeting. Back on the street outside City Hall, a man named Greg tells me that when it comes to the warehouse, this is just the beginning.
We're not going to stand for it. We're going to be at this facility every day. We will stand outside and we will protest this until they shut it down.
As I'm getting ready to leave, a young boy taps me on the shoulder and asks if he can do an interview. He's holding a sign that says, ICE sucks.
Well, I just, like, hate ICE because, like, they like to, like, hurt people. And they're just bad.
I ask him how he found out about ICE, and he says he saw a video online of ICE shooting someone.
You saw that video?
Yeah.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
11.
Had you ever seen anything like that before?
No, I have not.
It made you feel sad?
Yeah. They're just, like, doing that, and it hurts my heart.
We reached out to DHS for comment on the warehouse and the city's reaction to it. They sent us a statement, which reads in part, quote, ICE purchased land in Surprise, Arizona to build a processing facility that will hold approximately 1,500 beds. Every day, DHS is conducting law enforcement activities across the country to keep Americans safe. It should not come as news that ICE will be making arrests in states across the U.S. and is actively working to expand detention space.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation, Basis Charter Schools, Palo Verde Generating Station and SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online and on the KJZZ mobile app.